support that which is true, and do not divide things into what are pleasant and what are unpleasant, regardless of their integrities. So we say that it's a very good idea, and I think maybe most people will find it possible, to take one or two problems that you have, and which perhaps for a long time you have considered to be perfectly correct, and ask yourself in this particular instance, under question, is my opinion kind? Is it constructive? Is it an opinion that will lead to constructive consequences? Is it generous? Is it gentle? And is it the kind of an opinion that you would expect to find supported by the words of Christ? In this opinion problem, are you actually informed on this particular prejudice or this particular attitude? Are you really entitled to it? And if you are not certain, then the thing to do is to become involved in the other side of the problem. If it is a case in which you have heard a report about a person who has said unkind things about you, probably the best thing to do is go right to that person and find out why. And if you find out that the thing they did not like is worthy of criticism, then your idea that they are opinionated is wrong. They are factual. Very often, adverse opinions relating to ourselves are indications of weaknesses that we should work with. But instead of accepting them and trying to work with them, we never speak again to the person who brought them. We do not want to be disturbed. And opinions are very fragile, and the need to defend them is obvious, because we have to fight to defend them all the time. No one has to fight to defend truth, because truth can have no defense and cannot be defended, or can it be defeated? It is. It does not require anything. But untruth has to be bolstered up every day. Untruth is like a bad diet program. You have to work with it every minute. Just try to stay on your feet. Therefore, the matter of the Gordian knot comes into focus. Where possible, take an opinion against a person directly to that person. You may get into trouble. They may never speak to you again. But that only reverses the situation, because you intended never to speak to them again. And the result is that in most cases, you go to lunch together afterwards. It is very easy also for people to develop prejudices because of the prejudices of others. The fact that a statement comes to us does not necessarily prove it to be true. And of all the forces in this world that have created tragedy, even worse than dictatorships and wars and plagues, has been just plain simple gossip. It is the greatest source of tragedy, I suppose, that has ever existed in the world. So we have to be very careful in judging things. We have to be sure that we have the facts. Now, if we have the facts of a situation, really have them, and know beyond any reasonable doubt that we have the facts, then we have to plan a campaign or a course of procedure appropriate to the need. If these facts offer an opportunity to be of service to another person and help them to correct the situation, that becomes our responsibility. We are not responsible for circumstances which have never been brought to our attention. But what we have thought about, meditated on, and come to conclusions about become our responsibilities. So we should try to do everything possible to correct the situation. If it arises from an incompatibility, in which for the facts of the matter, there may be no regular or real fault, except a chemical compound that is not harmonious, if there is incompatibility, then we should accept it as such, and either attempt to be compatible by changing ourselves, or recognize that we are of no value to the other person also, and therefore we will quietly, lovingly, and in a friendly manner no longer create the condition which brings about the tension. We just discontinue an association that is not feasible, practical, or useful. But in all of it, a very kindly, friendly attitude. If we are in the presence of persons who are making mistakes, we can criticize, but we can also be sorry for them. We can wish we could help them, and sometimes perhaps we can. But prejudice nearly always results from failure to do anything constructive. It is merely continuing the old way of hatreds that have brought the world war after war, have broken countless homes, led to numerous inquisitions, and have destroyed the peace of mankind since the beginning of history. As we go on into a religious point of view, we must outgrow these things or we will perpetuate them. Recently, the situation in Iran indicates that religious intolerance is still present, but it is present because of ignorance. And it is because of collective ignorance that Iran is in trouble. And it is because of private and personal influence or conditions that the individual who is religiously intolerant is in trouble. Now, religious intolerance does not justify itself. I just cannot accept that deity wants us to remain ignorant of every belief except our own. If there wasn't a reason why different beliefs are necessary, it seems unreasonable that heaven should have produced them in the first place. Yet we know that all over the world, people have received religious revelation, that it has become tremendously important in their lives, and that when they have lived it, it has brought about a great improvement in their own characters and in their own lives. Maybe some of you recently saw the new picture that has come out on Marco Polo and the Mongol Emperor Kublai. On the back of an elephant in the heart of Mongolia, Kublai Khan, back in those days, declared religious tolerance to all his people. And he said that if any member of any religion persecuted, defrauded, damaged, or downgraded the member of another religion, he must be severely punished and punished by the state. Now, that was long ago, but it was a sign that was valuable. The Indian Emperor Ashoka, who was more or less a warrior pagan, was converted to Buddhism and then established his country on religious principles. His throne at Fatehpur Sikri in India is on the top of a column, and on the four sides of the column are bridges going out to four subsidiary thrones. On one was seated a Brahmin priest. On another was seated a Buddhist priest. On the third was a Christian priest, and on the fourth a Jewish priest. And these were the councilors of state. In isolated instances, the great facts have become evident. But we are still much limited by prejudice. Now, it is wrong, I think, also to proselyte. I don't think that we should try to take people away from their faith. But if we can help them to enlarge their understanding of their faith so that it is of greater help and strength to them and leads them closer to a life of useful contentment, then we can perform a natural and proper service. All through life, prejudice destroys our right to serve. That which we are prejudiced against, we do not help. We do not help to improve it. We do not help to correct the various faults which we feel exist there. So all through life, in science, art, literature, music, everywhere, the prejudice problem must be understood. Sometimes it is plain jealousy. We are jealous of those whose accomplishments appear to be greater than our own. We are jealous of those who are more successful and rise higher in social situations than ourselves. All kinds of causes can lie behind this prejudice. And the only way that we can solve it is to examine into ourselves. Find out what makes us tick. Find out, if we possibly can, why we think the way we do and feel the way we do. And then measure up very quietly the attitude we hold with the spiritual convictions we claim to believe. The greatest difficulty we have at the present time is that religion, though it controls in many ways probably 75% of humanity, has never recognized the inevitable need of practicing the virtues of faith, to forgive and forget. Remember the lawsuit problem, in which individuals go to litigation without a moment's pause. They should remember the words of St. Paul, who had the answer for that. Forgive thine enemy quickly while thou art on the way with him, because if you don't, he'll drag you into court. Now, these things, we can use the Bible very successfully to find out how we can react to the circumstances of our own existence. Most of those of us who have gone into religion rather deeply and have made the faith of man part of our study and purpose for life have a fair knowledge of the beliefs of others. And we realize that these beliefs must be measured on the terms of the integrity which they have. And the follower is measured by whether or not he maintains the highest level of the faith he does accept. We are not in trouble nearly as much because we believe the wrong things, but because whatever we believe, we do not do the right things. So we encourage every person to analyze himself using his spiritual convictions, the beliefs that are closest to his heart and mind, as the basis of self-analysis, and find out what the good book would say about the attitude he is taking on almost any particular condition. Now, this means, for instance, that there are lots of small things that will help to guide our direction. I know that people who get very excited, I've known several, complain afterwards of headaches or stomach aches or go down into the dumps or have all kinds of remorse mechanisms. Now, these arise partly from chemistry, because the individual who breaks rules, whether he knows it or not, is punished. He is punished by the body, which is one thing he cannot convert to anything. No matter how hard he tries, the stomach remains the master of itself and, to a large degree, the general secretary of his life. There is no power in the world by which the individual can cause the processes of elimination to be changed by an attitude, except for the worse. So, knowing the facts of these things, we have rules and guides. If, at the end of a temper fit, we are miserable and share our miseries generously with those around us, then this is something we shouldn't have, because misery is not an asset, it is not a virtue, and even in the most desperate circumstances, it is not commendable. Now, supposing, however, you do come upon someone or something that is really bad, that every evidence, every thought, every research you can do indicates that this person is undesirable, that they are a troublemaker in themselves, or they have refuse to recognize any standard of integrities. Now, you have no right, perhaps, to pass judgment on them, because even under these conditions, if you were in their place and had the same background, circumstances, and heredity that they had, you might have done the same thing. But the problem now remains is that, having discovered something that is essentially wrong and realizing that it's not curable, then the best and simplest answer is to have a heart-to-heart talk with that person and set the matter straight. If they are not doing the right thing and they know it as well as you do, then you have a perfect right to accept either an apology and an effort to improve, or simply disassociate yourself with them. But this does not mean that you have a right to damn them, that you have a right to condemn them, have a temper fit, scream at them, shout, and throw them out the front door. You should quietly, and holding your own integrities intact, give righteous judgment in a gentle, kindly way, always regretting that it will not perhaps be effective. But no one in an emergency has a right to go down on the level of another person and scream and shout at them. These things we have to gradually discipline ourselves against, because very often prejudices lead to anger, and anger may even lead to physical violence. But in every instance, the thoughtful person must control themselves. They must try in every way to commit no evil in the presence of a strong inducement to commit evil. So if you can't make it work, if it doesn't solve itself, if the problems are not reasonable, then the only answer is to close off the situation, wishing no one any harm, but refusing to become part of a condition that is going to remain incompatible indefinitely. Now, this is one of the problems that arises also in the home today. And home life is getting to be a matter of a considerable amount of prejudice. It is now becoming increasingly evident that the home is fragile, and that the various attitudes of persons are more or less incompatible with natural law regarding the home. Now, what is the actual basic principle upon which a home is based? A home is based upon a pattern that it comes from heaven itself. It is something which is justified and authorized by the divine plan of things. Every form of life must have some form of home or security or some basis of operation, and it is also indispensable to the perpetuation of every species that exists. Home also is a psychological experience of the greatest value, because home is the most positive opportunity for the maturing of the emotional life. If our minds are cleared and deepened and integrated by a course on computers, the emotional life is really receiving the postgraduate course of education in the home. The home is the challenge. It is also the laboratory for the release, integration, and ennoblement of the emotional quotient in human nature. The home, therefore, is a challenge, and it has much more to do with growth than we are likely to assume. To many people today, the home is just simply a place to sleep, or a place in which to change your clothes, or a nice quiet spot to watch television. The home is not what it used to be. Perhaps it never was, but we like to think it was. But one thing is certain, that the maturing, developing, and ennobling of the home is one of the laws of heaven. Confucius summed it up in a very simple statement 25 centuries ago, when he said, "The strength of a nation depends upon the integrity of its homes." All public institutions, all world events, all human achievement and failure must trace back directly to the home. The home is the earth from which the seeds of achievement grow. The home is the solid ground upon which empire can be built. When the home fails, the world fails. So with this thought in mind, it becomes a great place for philosophical insights, for discipline. And discipline often requires something that we do not like to admit, and most people are very reluctant to allow for it, and that is the dignity of opinions that differ from our own. Must we always feel that it is necessary to convert somebody to something? Why can we not have families in which differences of opinion on secular matters, or even on theological matters, do not interfere with the integrity of the home or the affection of the members. The reason why we have trouble in this is because of the missionary instinct. A religious conversion in a home is a mistake. The thing that is important in the home is to quietly decide whether or not whatever we believe, we are obeying it. And that religion means the use of our insights, our spiritual insights, to discover the identity of the deity in all of us. The home is a perfect place in which the individual can come to realize the indwelling God, to be found in the family, in the relatives and friends, and in the associates, in the environment. In the home, the God of all peoples comes to dwell in each one of the members of that family. And when one turns against the other, he turns against the God in the other. So if people are living well, doing well, thinking well, there is no reason why interreligious marriage, and in many instances interracial marriages, cannot succeed. They represent very often, however, a problem in which prejudice confronts realities and overwhelms them. So whatever it is, the home is very important. And in the home, every value that is essentially religious comes into focus. A home is a place in which parents learn their responsibilities for their own children. They learn the responsibility of giving life and protecting life. They have experiences that cannot be found anywhere else or in any other part of nature. But these experiences are very close to God, very close to truth, and are most ennobling experiences in human life. Where affections can be brought into a disciplined relationship, where affections work out in beauty, in integrity, and in highest convictions and beliefs, you have as near a perfect situation as you will find anywhere in the human state. Therefore, we may say that every good home is a chapel, and every poor home is a ruined church. And this we have to try to do what we can about in order to help protect the future and make a better world for all of us to live in. But here again, prejudice must be overcome. Here, the desperate determination to change somebody's point of view must be overcome. The only thing we have a right to hope to change is that hope to bring the individual closer to his own convictions, the best of them. And argument is useless. The only good teacher in home relationships is example. And the example of gentleness may be overlooked. It may be rejected, but it is the duty of the individual who has constructive convictions to live those convictions kindly and gently, hoping continuously that they will assist the other members of the family to a better relationship with life. So prejudice, in another sense of the word, is an emotion against God. It is an emotion against the deity in ourselves. It is an emotion against any religion, philosophy, or science that is worth anything or worth bothering with. A prejudice is something that is usually a defense mechanism. It is an effort of the individual to overlook, deny, or escape from his own mistakes. And it is very essential that he accept the fact that he has these prejudices and go to work and clear them out. At the present time, we are much worried socially about conditions in the world. And practically all the unhappiness that is in present society is derived basically from some form of prejudice. It is prejudice against truth. It is the unwillingness to see the truth in the beliefs of other countries, even though we expect them to accept our truths. It is a tendency for each nation to try to impose its own rules, doctrines, and beliefs upon other powers, when the proper course of procedure is to inspire each power, each nation and country, to release the best part of itself. Every nation involved in trouble today, at the moment at least, has some religious background. Many of them are devoutly religious. And yet their various religions are not producing the effect that is necessary. People are not able to live up to the convictions they hold. And this is largely excused by turning animosity upon another person. If we do not want to change, we make the other person wrong and insist that our own point of view is correct. If we do not want peace in the world, we will always blame another nation for causing war. If we have trouble in the business, our tendency is to assume that somebody else is delinquent, dishonest, or inefficient. We do not accept the challenge of trying to do the thing through greater insight ourselves. We must try as far as we can, we're all limited, but we must try to get rid of this whole problem of being prejudiced through constant watchfulness, through a continuous application of thoughtfulness. Now, another simple attitude on this is, if we read newspapers, or if we listen to commentators or news broadcasts, we should be very, very quiet. Quietness in this matter does not mean approval. It means attention. It means that as we hear the news, we think about it. We do not allow the commentator to think for us. We do not allow the news analyst to overwhelm our own judgments. We do not allow political differences to prejudice us against facts. We find somewhere in the program something we don't quite understand. We don't understand why it should be that way. Then the point should be given further consideration. If necessary, read a book about it. But sure, be sure that you are not making up a mass mind that is being under very strong propaganda. Do not allow other people to disturb you unless you are sure that they are right. And then if you are sure that they are right, you probably will not be disturbed. You will decide in your mind what should be done and how it could be done. It is very, very necessary to escape this constant pressure of prejudice. Commercial advertising is loaded with it. And most products are subtly trying to prejudice you against other products. Each one is trying to tell you that it's better than all the others. And we go along with it as we would a game, because we all have a general realization that the different products may all be made by the same manufacturer and simply be labeled differently and sold competitively to create a little more action. So we should learn these things and not allow prejudiced attitudes or prejudiced institutions to get in under our common sense. No prejudice can stand common sense. And common sense is man's most uncommon sensory perception. It is judgment. Common sense is the ability to see the facts after they have been carefully camouflaged for private interests. Prejudice is not a virtue. Loyalty to mistakes is not justified. All loyalty must be to that which is the greatest good, so far as we are able to know that good. Never are we presumed to assume that patriotism to a prejudice is a legitimate virtue. It is not, and never can be. So all of us, I know every day we come upon these things. For one reason or another, somebody runs down another person because they'd like to have their job. Another one runs down something else because they really want to have their own opinion come first. And I know a great many persons who run down the Ten Commandments because they object to them. Now, objection in the study of natural law is vanity. There's nothing that is less productive than an effort to object to values as they really are. We cannot reject or object in matters relating to divine laws. We have to realize that the miseries and sorrows of this life we know of are not due to the tyranny of deity. They are due to the fact that we do not obey the laws of creation, which not only did deity bring into existence, but must obey himself. So that we have no right to be prejudiced against God and become an atheist. And even Robert Ingersoll, who was well known as an atheist, admitted that he wasn't really an atheist. He was an agnostic. He said, "I do not object to God. I don't know anything about God. But I certainly do object to some of the people who claim to know about God." He said, "I object to faiths and doctrines which will build beautiful cathedrals up into the air and dungeons underneath to imprison and torture human beings." He said, "I don't object to deity. I don't know what it is. But I do object to the way that religion has divided, broken up, and fought among itself for centuries." And I think we all have that same problem to face to a degree. We have prejudices against religions, but they are prejudices against persons who have perverted and misused these religions. There is no need for us to give up anything that is good. There is no need for us to use religion as a means of evasion. We are not here to use our religion as an escape from our daily jobs. We are here to use our religion as an inspiration to ensoul honest labor and virtuous life and make it help to advance our eternal dignities. Now, when we do depart from here, wherever we go, we are going to perhaps come into a realm that we're not too familiar with here. We do not really know all about what's going to happen in the future. We might go over there and find some of our prejudices are all wrong, but it may be too late then to do very much about them. We may also find over there something that we must all learn over here if we want to succeed in life, and that is that there is a wonderful universe, that this universe was created by a divine spiritual power, and that this power has created all things with love and wisdom and has given to each of its creatures a measure of that love and wisdom. And of the creatures that we know, man has been most richly endowed with that love and wisdom. And through the love and wisdom of that which created us, we shall find the way of our own redemption. We shall be redeemed and brought back to the truth of matters by the wisdom and love of the divine within ourselves. The manifestation of that wisdom and love, as in the case of deity, is certainly patience, for the universe has gone on for an inconceivable period of time under the continual love and wisdom of deity. All things are fulfilled in their due times. Patience is a great virtue, and by patience we shall all achieve. But if we constantly watch our ways, if we continually use time as a way of growing, if we use experiences as a way of discovering God, if we use our acquaintances with other people as ways of enlarging our understanding of life, and if we simply say prejudices have no place in this, that we cannot afford to be prejudiced against God or against each other. We are here to overcome all false opinions by the illumination of our inner lives. That on the outside may cause prejudice, on the inside reconciles all things in affection, friendship, and wisdom. And we can start here then to use our cooperative faculties rather than our competitive faculties in estimating the values and virtues of mankind. Well, I guess that's all for this morning.